Good afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Katie Hannan. My panel today, Thomas Byrne, Minister of State for European Affairs, Jed Nash, Labour Party spokesperson on finance, public expenditure and reform, and Louise O'Reilly, Sinn Féin spokesperson on enterprise, trade and employment. You can text us on 51551, email saturday@rte.ie or tweet to @SaturdayRTE. Now, just as we were coming to air, the news broke that the Ulster Unionist leader, Steve Aiken, had announced his resignation. I'm joined on the line now by our Northern editor, Vincent Carney. Vincent, this is a surprise announcement. Have we got Vincent on the line?
Hello?
Yes, Vincent, we're hearing you. Are you hearing us? I think we might be struggling with that connection to Vincent.
Hi.
Oh, can you hear us now, Vincent?
Are you? Okay. I can hear you loud and clear, yeah.
Okay, you're on air. You're on air now, Vincent. We just literally, this broke just as we were preparing to come into studio today. Was it expected in any way?
Perhaps not expected today, but not a surprise entirely. Steve Aiken has been under pressure for some time. He was viewed as ineffectual in his leadership. There have been some talk of a move against him potentially a couple of weeks ago, but then Arlene Foster was forced to step aside as leader of the DUP and First Minister. So the Ulster Unionist Party then sort of set their own discussion and debate aside. So this has come today. So in terms of the timing, it is a surprise, but in terms of him actually stepping down, no. I think in the last few weeks, the view was it was a matter of when, not if. He has been viewed, as I say, by his own party members as being ineffectual. And he took part in a BBC Radio Ulster radio interview a couple of weeks back that was an absolute disaster for him. Many within his party were exasperated by his contribution to that programme. So this is all about getting ready for the election. The election will be in May of next year. The DUP will obviously have a new leader going into that election. And many within the Ulster Unionist Party felt that if they have any chance at all of staving off the new threat from the DUP and perhaps even gaining some seats, that they could not do it under Steve Aiken. So I think he's listened to the grassroots within the party who were telling him that it was time to go.
And of course, he himself was elected unopposed in 2019. Any thoughts yet on what the leadership contest will look like in the UUP now?
Well, I think many within the UUP would like to go back to their former leader, Robin Swan, the current health minister, because the view is that he's done very well during COVID. He's handled the pandemic quite well, and the vaccination rollout in Northern Ireland is going very well. He may not want to step back in. He said he was stepping aside for personal reasons. He wanted to spend more time with his family. Now, a close colleague of Steve Aiken, he's a former submarine commander in the British Royal Navy. A former colleague of his, Doug Beattie, is a former British Army officer who was awarded the Military Cross. He's an MLA for Upper Ban. So I think some within the party would see Doug Beattie as a potential leader. Some would want to go take a step backwards to Robin Swan. As yet, no one has formally declared. But as you said, just back in 2019 in November, no one else actually put their hat in the ring. Now, I think that says a lot about the state of play within the Ulster Unionist Party. And of course, this comes in Northern Ireland's centenary year. So it couldn't happen at a worse time for unionists. They're talking about celebrating Northern Ireland being 100 years old. And now both parties, the DUP and Ulster Unionist Party, are in a state of internal flux.
Indeed. And as you say there, Doug Beattie, of course, we've been hearing a lot from him this week because he's come out very strongly against those reports or the suggestion that there's maybe an amnesty from prosecution for British soldiers that would have been indicted for crimes during the Troubles.
Yeah, that's right. He's been a very outspoken critic of that. He's also said, as a former British soldier himself, he has said that he believes if former British soldiers broke the law, that they should face the courts like anyone else. But he was outraged at the possibility that former IRA members and former Loyalist paramilitaries could also be excluded from prosecution. He cited the example of the Dublin Monaghan bombings, saying that those responsible would walk free if this legislation was introduced. Now, in the past, because of his close relationship and friendship with Steve Aiken, the view was that Doug Beattie would not go up against him in a leadership contest. But now that Steve Aiken has stepped aside, Doug Beattie, if he has leadership ambitions, I would say we'll feel he's not inhibited anymore and we'll go for it.
Okay, well, we will, as they say, watch this space. Vincent Carney, many thanks for joining us with that update and that breaking news from Northern Ireland today. Thomas Byrne, were you surprised by that development?
Well, I certainly, knowingly that it would be happening, look, it's a matter for the Ulster Unionist Party. We wish him well and the contribution that he has made, and it will be an internal matter of the Ulster Unionist Party to select a new leader. I suppose the most important thing from our point of view is that the Assembly remains functioning and that we can, you know, try to get everybody, north and south, within the north and between east and west, working very, very well together. And clearly there's a delicate balance at the moment, and we want to make sure we don't upset that balance too much.
Yeah, a lot of turmoil in unionist politics in Northern Ireland.
There is,
Louise O'Reilly.
There is indeed, Katie. This is, and of course, you know, I want to acknowledge this is a tough day for Steve Aiken and for his family and for his supporters. You know, I mean, it's always tough. We don't know yet the reasons, and we don't have, you know, a full suite of information. But it's clear that unionism is at a crossroads, and at a time when leadership has never been more important, they find themselves leaderless, and that is that's very worrying. You know, we saw in the most recent elections the end of the inbuilt unionist majority, and that, I think, is causing sending shockwaves. You know, the politics of change. We don't just talk about that in the south. That is very much in the north, and it's been driven by Brexit and by other factors. And so, I think, you know, it's a matter for the Ulster Unionist Party who leads them. They have a decision to make now. We will, of course, continue to work with all parties right across the Assembly to ensure that we can bring that stability.
Okay, and Vincent Carney mentioned one of the contenders may well be Robin Swan, and that he's, of course, Northern Ireland's Health Minister. He has written, we understand now, to the government to try and prevent non-essential cross-border travel due to concerns about the impact that shopping and socialising could have on the spread of the virus on both sides of the border. What will the government's response to that be, Thomas Byrne?
Well, I haven't seen the letter. I was made aware of it this morning. Look, we have a very close working relationship, north and south, on health matters, but clearly there's two different jurisdictions there as well in terms of the rules. We are opening up inter-county travel on Monday. That doesn't mean that everyone has to go gangbusters at it, but I mean, it will be essential for lots and lots of people. That is on an all-Ireland basis. If Robin Swan feels the need to introduce restrictions in the north, that's a matter for them. But we haven't done this on a 26-county basis at any point. It's always been done on a 32-county basis. But I think, you know, as things start to open up, I mean, the message very much, first of all, is outdoors as best you can, but also to be cautious as well, that this is not...
You can't go shopping outdoors. We're going to open up non-essential shopping.
We are opening up non-essential shopping as well next week. Yes, it's by appointment for next week. So the restrictions are, you know, they're different, but there are some similarities, particularly around shopping and non-essential shopping.
He's requesting an urgent meeting with Stephen Donnelly and department officials and senior public health bosses from both jurisdictions. Do we know if that meeting has been scheduled at this stage?
I don't know if it's been scheduled, but I have no doubt that public health bosses, as are described, will be only too happy to work together, as they have worked together where they
can.
Well,
have they, though? Because there was complaints from Robin Swan earlier in this pandemic, from well into this pandemic, that they were still asking for information from those passenger information forms to be shared, and they were not getting that cooperation.
But look, I mean, you know, people, there can be a blame game played. Look, we've seen the Indian different variants in Northern Ireland that, you know, there's no mandatory hotel quarantine because allegedly they didn't need it. But on the other hand, we have seen public health officials work very well together, particularly in border areas. And we saw Ronan Glynn working with his colleague Derry in Donegal. That has happened. But at the end of the day, there's two separate governments there. There's a common travel area. Some of what's happening in the north is dictated in London. And we have certainly left no stone unturned to make sure that we are working as closely as possible with our Northern Ireland colleagues.
Let me bring in Jed Nash, because you are in a border constituency. Jed, would you be concerned about what may happen now over the coming weeks?
I am, and I would ask people in my own constituency and across the border to be very responsible about how they operate over the next period of time. Yeah. I mean, we know that hospitality, for example, will be open and is open at the moment to a degree in the north. And I have an anecdotal evidence of people taking advantage of that. Not everybody in Northern Ireland, of course, while they're much further advanced in the vaccination programme, is vaccinated, so therefore they're not safe. I mean, we've had issues over the last few months. I mean, I wrote to the then Health Minister, Simon Harris, this time last year, requesting that there would be, you know, better coordination with the north, particularly from the point of view of, if not prohibiting, but certainly managing cross-border travel better. And it's actually only in the last couple of months.
How do you? But what do you mean by that, though? Sorry to cut across, Jed Nash.
I'll tell you what I mean by it. I mean, we had serious issues in North Louth, for example, with lots of people coming over the border to enjoy days out in, you know, in beautiful Carlingford and Omeath and places like that at the height of this pandemic. And essentially a blind eye was being turned. There was no formal cooperation both sides of the border. There was a lot of lip service paid to it. And that certainly, but I think, are put you people suggesting, in danger, I'm just, both north and south.
So I'm just wondering, need proper
coordination on this and make sure that everybody's on the same page.
But what practically could be done? Are you suggesting that there should be checkpoints and cars turned back at the border?
Not at this stage, though. I did argue at the height of the pandemic, when things were exceptionally dangerous and when we didn't have sight of a horizon in terms of the vaccination programme, that there should be a formal check either side of the border. That was introduced, and I think that has helped us to get to the point that we're at this point in time. I'm just asking for people to take on personal responsibility as well. I won't say we're nearly there, but we're making great progress north and south. So there needs to be, you know, very clear formal cooperation to get this right.
Yeah, if you called for checks on this side of the border back when that was the issue, I'll let you in one moment, Minister. Would you accept the reciprocation now that there would be checks on the other side of the border, turning back?
Well, we expected them, and PSNI and Garda Síochána were working closely together. The restrictions, remember, the north were kind of voluntary. They weren't imposed on anybody. There were no regulations that could be necessarily imposed or enforced in terms of travel. And this is the issue that we've had. And we've got two jurisdictions. I mean, and that's why we need as much coordination as possible.
Whether that's formal or informed, preferably formal.
I just make a point, and I agree with some of what Jed has said, but you know, for much of the last 4 months, it was an offence to be anywhere outside 5 kilometres, except for essential purposes. You know, you couldn't go. So if you're from the north and you're coming in, it was an offence. You didn't need checkpoints necessarily on the border. Now we're saying on Monday that we're opening up inter-county travel. So we're moving into a new phase. And I certainly haven't heard that the north are saying, or Robin Swan is saying, that it's illegal to travel in the north. I haven't. If it is, then we better announce that to people.
I haven't heard that. You're right, Thomas. It's not illegal.
So we're saying we're opening up because we're opening up gradually. But at the same time, as Jed said, we're trying to be very, very careful about it too.
Inter-county travel is going to open up, and that's very welcome. You know, what we have heard repeatedly from Robin Swan is a lack of coordination and a lack of information coming from the Department of Health in Dublin. And I mean, that's not good. There needs to be information sharing north and south. I know that Michelle O'Neill has raised this on a number of occasions, and I know that Robin Swan has also raised it. So there does need to be information sharing. We need to, you know, acknowledge the fact that this is a small island. We should be working together to ensure that the public health measures are observed. But the thing we can't lose sight of, Katie, and this is the important thing, every single day of the week, thousands of people cross the border for essential reasons, because they work.
Absolutely.
Now, they don't work, or they live in Dundalk and they work in Uri, or they live in Uri and they work in Dundalk, or any one of a number of scenarios. That the vast majority of people are responsible. The vast majority of people are doing what they are supposed to do. And the vast majority of people who cross the border every day do so for absolutely essential purposes.
OK, I want to move on because, in relation to the opening up next week, reports today that despite the fact that 400,000 people are on the pandemic unemployment payment, retailers are having serious difficulty, it appears, getting staff for the reopening. Louise O'Reilly, what should we take from that?
Well, I think I spoke to people not necessarily in retail but in hospitality, and they said they had lost a lot of staff to London, actually, as it goes. An awful lot of their staff had gone and they had sought work because the economy in Britain was open up quicker. So there was work there, and they had gone to get that work. I think one of the things that the government needs to do is ensure that there isn't a cliff edge, to give people some certainty so that they can know when they go back to work that should they need them, because I think there's a fear for a lot of retailers that they will open, but maybe because of all the warehouse debt, they might find it difficult to continue. So I think we do need to ensure that that they have that security. There's not that cliff edge on the 1st of July. And I think also we need to
look. So what you're saying, that people are afraid that the shop or whatever business they're going back to work in may not actually survive.
I think
they will
fear.
Have given up their PUP payment,
that
and then they'll fear. Be on the much lower.
That is a fear. And
thing.
I mean, the other thing, like, if we want to broaden out this debate, we need to look at Mandate Trade Union are talking about a new deal for retail workers. So looking at how retail operates, how we can ensure that we have decent work and decent pay, because let's not forget that during this pandemic, thousands of retail workers, I'm talking about the Debenhams workers, the workers in Arcadia, in Carphone, warehouse. They lost their jobs. They didn't have their collective agreements honoured, and they effectively find themselves in a situation now that Debenhams workers have been on strike for more than 400 days. Other workers found themselves in a situation whereby they were unceremoniously dumped and they don't have any recourse. So we do need to look at the whole area of retail, how we can reform it, how we can ensure we build in decent jobs, and how we can ensure that it's an attractive place for people to work. And we also need to look at our city centres and our towns. We need to make them attractive places for people to come so that they will use the retail that is there.
Is the government concerned at these reports, Thomas Byrne, that they're... people are struggling, employers seriously struggling to entice people back off the pandemic unemployment.
I'm not sure it's a question of enticement. If your job is back, I mean, your job is back. What I would say is, first of all, there are thousands of...
We've heard that there may be 1,000 staff short in the Dundrum shopping centre alone. Okay.
Well, I'd say on the other hand, there are thousands of retailers up and down this country who just cannot wait to get back open. And I'm really looking forward to it myself for them, because their businesses have been closed for so long. And I've no doubt that they will be absolutely ready, willing and able and wanting to get back selling. Look, ordinarily, if there's a lot of jobs there, it's good news. I would say that the figures that have been given is 500, 800, 1,000. We don't know. Are the reasons because of... there are various reasons given. One of them is that they don't maybe have enough time. I'm sure those...
Are you going to come under pressure now, I just think, from employers that say that as long as you are giving people who may have been perhaps part-time workers in the past, who are now getting the pandemic unemployment payment, they need those part-time workers back in, but they can't offer them an equivalent pay. And are you going to come under pressure from those employers to say, look, until this pandemic unemployment thing goes away, we're going to have this problem?
I'm not aware of pressure from employers. The pressure from employers is to get back open their businesses, and we very much welcome the start of that next week and then the following week as well. The bottom, if your job is back, then your job is back. And I would agree as well. I mean, retail is in general, especially the large multiples, certainly have to look at terms and conditions as well, and part-time. And, it's up to their private businesses too. And many of them are huge multinationals. I think they're well able to make sure that they're attractive to the staff that they have. And we've seen retail workers in essential services do extraordinary work over the last year. And we've seen some of those companies as well reacting with better terms and conditions. And that's really, really well.
Some of those companies. I think Jed Nash?
Yeah, I mean, this is to a point a commentary on the preponderance of low pay and casual hours contracts in the retail sector. And if anything is to come out of the pandemic, it should be a drive forward in terms of improving people's working conditions and their pay rates, and a move towards a living wage that I've endorsed for a long, long time now, to make sure that work pays and provide people with the dignity that they need at work. Now, I understand obviously retailers are anxious and nervous, they're dipping their toe back in the water in very uncertain times, and that's why when ultimately the pandemic unemployment payment is tapered down and wound down when the conditions are appropriate, we have argued over the last year now for a German-style short-time working scheme to support sectors that are going to find it difficult to re-emerge from the point that they're at the moment to get back to viability. So that's something I think that the government should seriously consider, convert the EWSS into a more embedded sort of scheme in the labour market to support companies dipping their toe in the water at this very, very uncertain time. But, and elaborating just a little bit, if I can, for a moment on what Louise said in relation to the prospect of, for example, really, really difficult times that the retail sector and the hospitality sector might be facing. I mean, 5 years ago now, in response to the Cleary's debacle, I produced the Duffy Cahill report, which proposed a number of different improvements to legislation to protect workers who are caught up in deemed insolvencies. Two governments later, no reforms have been introduced to better serve the interests of workers who are at the back of the queue. Look at what happened in Debenhams. We're staring down the barrel potentially of considerable number of job losses through liquidations over the next period of time. It's time the government acted on that.
Okay. I'm going to leave that one there, because I just want to ask about that Dr. Tony Hoolan yesterday, and those antigens, those supermarket antigen tests that have become available. He came out very strongly against that, I think to some people's surprise yesterday, saying don't buy them, don't use them, very worried that it might have consequences for people. How do we feel about that? And how do we feel about antigen tests generally and the role they should have?
Well, just in relation to Lidl, I'm a little bit surprised. Generally speaking, Lidl have a good reputation, and they have. They've, on the living wage and even community consultation when they're building supermarkets, I've seen them really, really good. But on this one, I mean, you know, if you've got COVID symptoms, you need a test, but you need treatment as well. And that's why it's free to ring your GP. You don't need to go to Lidl. You ring your GP, you self-isolate immediately. Are Lidl going to do contact tracing? I mean, these are issues that just have not been discussed. And I suspect that's why Tony Holohan has been extremely strong about this. This is a big public health thing. There is no charge to ring your doctor. You must self-isolate, and the HSE then will do contact tracing. So I've no doubt that's the reason. I mean, self-administered antigen tests, I don't know what exact role that they have. I mean, they certainly wouldn't work for travel, for example. If you have to do essential travel, you have to go and get a certified one. So you think
Lidl are being irresponsible? Is that what you're...
I just would be very wary of getting involved in public health measures when I'm not a public health person like Lidl. I mean, they're a good supermarket. They've done good work. They've brought competition. I've no issue with that. But it's mixing up with public health. And I certainly would agree with Tony Holohan. I'd be very, very cautious about this.
Okay. I want to move on to the digital green certs because this, of course, was discussed last night at the EU summit in Porto by European leaders. If this comes in June, as it's moving towards now, will we be legally obliged to adopt it, Thomas Byrne?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this is a regulation of the European Union that the member states and the European Parliament have to agree. So the negotiations are happening at the moment. It would be a legally binding regulation imposing an obligation on the state and a right on citizens to get this.
Okay. When are we expecting it to be in place, and how long will it be in place for?
Well, I don't have direct control over that, because what's happening at the moment is that the European Parliament and the Member States are negotiating. So whenever that finishes, I think there's a European Parliament plenary session towards the end of June to finalise it, and the Member States do it, I think, the following day. Those negotiations are happening at the moment. It's done through an expedited procedures. And all the while then, the Commission and the Member States are working to make sure it works and make sure we're working with the technology to make sure it's put in place while the legislation is going through. So, for example, there's an e-health network at European level. There's a lot of work going on. The Commission has published its own technical guidance on it. They've put in place a fund for member states to draw down. We've applied for that. So there's a lot of work going on. This is really difficult, but it's difficult for every member state. There's no doubt there is a legal obligation.
OK, but go back to the timing of it. What are we expecting?
We're expecting that it will be in place at the end of June. There may well be a transition period as part of it, but we have to await the outcome of the negotiation, see what it's 6 weeks at the moment, what the transition period would be that we would have to implement.
So once it
fully
comes in, you would have 6 weeks to get your ducks in a row, basically.
Up to, but the European Parliament wants to delete that. So we'll have to await the outcome of the negotiations. That's why member states are working very, very urgently to do this. And I think the public at that point, if the vaccination programme keeps going gangbusters the way it is at the moment and it's working and we don't have another wave like they had in Chile when they reached 50% of vaccines, the public will be demanding this. So
if it's in place by the end of June and it transpires a 6 week transition period, with the middle of August, people here should be entitled to travel under these.
That would be the very latest. But as I said, that 6 week period may not be there, and even if it is there, we may not need it. I mean, I'm hoping that we don't.
Perhaps any at the very latest is the middle of August.
Just be absolutely clear. Travel rules remain a matter for member states. So we will still this is to facilitate free movement, absolutely, and. Just to be clear as well to listeners, it's not a vaccination cert. It will also have a negative test result or a recovery result as well.
Okay, two questions. I'm just anxious.
And I'll give you some examples of that. So for example, some of the Mediterranean countries may let tourists in without vaccination, just if they have a negative test. And that'll be a matter for them. We may say, I don't know what we're going to say, because that'll be decided. We may say, you need vaccination or you need a negative test. I don't know. But the member states themselves will make that decision. What this will do is facilitate that. Now, already at the moment in Ireland, if you're fully vaccinated, you're entitled not to go into mandatory hotel quarantine. And what people are doing when they show up at the airport is they have certs or pieces of paper. Same for a negative test. They may have a text, they may have a piece of paper, an email, whatever. This will even standardise that for that. And it is very badly needed at the moment.
Okay. What will it do to our mandatory hotel quarantine system then? Can that operate side by side with this?
It's not directly related to it.
But will any EU citizens be directed towards mandatory hotel quarantine at that point then?
The exact position is that our travel arrangements are a matter for ourselves. So mandatory hotel quarantine is in place, I think, until the 9th of June. There's a sunset clause in it then. What's happening already is that the government is reviewing it, looking very closely at it to see what happens after that. Conscious, obviously, of the public health requirements. And also conscious of our fundamental rights of free movement within the European Union. That's okay. Clear. So we've gradually opened up, and I think we all want to open up even further, and we're just going to do it in a very, very careful way. But there's no doubt this is there. There's no doubt the vaccination programme is working and that we are moving towards this.
OK. I want to bring in Paul Hackett now, CEO of clickandgo.com and board member of the Irish Travel Agents Association. Paul, what assurances are you and your members looking for from the government in relation to the digital green cert?
The digital green certificates, Katie, are a really clear and safe pathway for the resumption of international travel for leisure and corporate reasons. And it was great to hear the Minister say this is a regulation and must be adopted in full with no veto potential from the Irish Government. It is very worrying when the Minister then goes on to start outlining that the Irish Government will maintain control on the various legal restrictions that are in place already on travel. We have over 40 pieces of legislation enacted this year alone which limit travel out of this country. When we're creating something across Europe that is a mass harmonisation piece of legislation that covers vaccination, testing and recovery, there should be no need to maintain those statutory instruments and other restrictions on travel because public health has been taken into account in this. It is not something that's loose or relaxed. It's people travelling when they are fully vaccinated, when they are tested or when they have recovered from COVID. So there should be absolutely no reason within the EU why we don't have the freedom of movement that is our right.
Okay, the Minister's nodding along to
that. Yeah, I'm agreeing with a lot of that. But what I would say is I'm simply stating as a matter of fact that it is a matter for us in terms of our travel regulations. And what we've done is we've opened up travel on an inter-county basis from Monday. So these things happen gradually. I'm not saying that this is a way out of it or anything. It's not. We want to do this, but we want to do it carefully. The regulation will not be in force until late June. So, you know, what we're saying is just let's take things very, very carefully at the moment. But clearly, freedom of movement is a fundamental EU right. That's why we're not in favour, for example, of Brexit and what they have lost. We've got to keep that. But it's simply a matter of fact that is just a matter for us. But we've all said we want to open this up, but let's do it safely and gradually.
And I totally agree, Minister, because we're not looking and speaking just from an outbound tourism perspective. We're talking for the airlines, the airports, the inbound business in this country, the hotels, the 350 to 400,000 jobs that rely, because this system does allow the EU to open inbound and outbound in a safe way.
Can I just ask, if we decide we can proceed with this along
we will
the lines,
be proceeding with it, yeah.
Well, without the caveats that were put in place there, do we have the digital infrastructure to do it? Will we be able to link up our vaccination records with, is it a phone app? Is that how
it'll be digital or paper, so it'll be a QR code. I would say on the vaccination it's probably easier. On the test result, that's what they're working on at the moment. I don't think any country would be able to open this up today or tomorrow on a technological basis, but thankfully we're doing it on a pan-European basis. The European Commission is doing huge work because they see freedom of movement as fundamental for all of us.
But
and we're feeding into that and working along with that.
Yeah, I was just saying, are there people on this case right now developing
this
technology?
Absolutely.
And are you confident that it will be there when we get the green light to go ahead with this?
I'm confident they're doing absolutely everything possible at the moment.
No, there's a difference.
I'm not going to take criticism from Sinn Féin. We're, you know, all for mandatory hotel quarantine. Forget about that now.
Thomas, I want to address. Mandatory hotel quarantine is your government's policy. Ye brought it in. Now, are you suggesting that the opposition are running the government policy? We're not. Mandatory hotel quarantine is your government's policy. Now, what we all want to see, Thomas, is not someone playing silly political games with this, because there's 140,000 plus jobs dependent on getting this right. So when the question is asked, is the infrastructure going to be in place? What we want to hear from you is that it is, not that you hope it is or that you're going to cross your fingers, that it will be in place because it is important.
Okay. Look, I've tried to give absolutely factual answers to you, Katie, on this. There's an entity called the European eHealth Network. They're working all the time now on this under Commissioner Didier Reynders. I'll be talking to him, I think, on Tuesday. And there's tremendous work going on at the moment. I say there's common kind of technological standards. There's money being provided by the European Commission. No country would be able to do this today, but all countries will have to have this in place when the regulation is enacted. Have to have this in place, Katie.
And this is very big news for the aviation sector and for tourism and hospitality. We're agreeing, Tom.
Both in aviation constituencies.
Yeah. Just bear with me for one moment. So what we need to see is, you know, one, a full explanation, because people are nervous about something that's a vaccine passport and all that. So that needs to be clear.
It's not.
I understand that, and you understand that, but there needs to be an information campaign. And and we need to know that it can be sustainable. But we also need to see, because, you know, we need to keep our connectivity, we need to protect those jobs, and inbound tourism is going to be really, really absolutely essential in the latter part of the summer if we can manage it, but even in the off-peak season, you know, because there's so many jobs riding on this, and we all want the government to get this right, to do their homework and to make sure that we're ready to go at the same time as our, as other European states. Yeah. That's all.
And can I just add, and I'll let you back in one moment, Minister, I just wanted to ask Paul Hackett, what are you telling your customers when they call wanting to book foreign holidays?
Most people in our industry, most members of the Irish Travel Agents Association, are saying later in the summer, because we are not clear as to when things are going to happen. We're very clear that this is going to be completed in the EU at the end of June. We're clear there's a 6-week lag, and beyond that, well, there's no clarity.
Or may not be now, according to the Minister.
Well, I think what the Minister said on the tech piece is very interesting, Katie, because we are probably the only country in Europe who does not have an integrated IT infrastructure in our health service. And I think, leaving travel aside, from a COVID point of view, this is one of the serious gaps that has been thrown up for the future in terms of public health, because it not only impacts the ability to implement the digital green certificates, and by the way, Minister, Denmark did so earlier this week with regard to some domestic areas of management of the digital green certificate within their own jurisdiction. So there is the capability to move to this quickly, but it's dependent on having an integrated IT infrastructure for our health service for us as citizens of the state.
Well, I don't think the digital green cert will be dependent on that. We're going to be bringing that in as part of the European, economic investment that's happening over the next year or so. But that will be separate, and that this will happen. We will have to happen. This will be a citizen's right, and that's certainly what I'm saying to officials, and I think they understand that very, very clearly.
Okay, and maybe I just put to Jed Nash. Mm-hmm. Jed, should we be concerned that we're all gung ho now? We're, you know, travel is going to open up internationally as well as nationally.
No, I don't think we're being gung-ho. I think everybody's trying to be really responsible, and I'm pleased that the Digital Green Cert initiative is progressing, and I need to be reassured, frankly, that the tech has been organised at the same time. I mean, this is really important. It's choreographed properly across the European Union to make sure that it's done safely and that it's done securely. But let's say this, I mean, three of us on the panel today actually come from constituencies and represent areas that are heavily dependent on the airport. And I don't really think, Dublin Airport in particular, I don't really think that people fully appreciate the strategic importance of airlines in the aviation sector, not just to our tourism sector, which is obviously crucially important, but to our business environment more generally. And I think it's really, you know, we need to be mindful of what Aer Lingus said yesterday. Don't believe that they're scaremongering. I mean, Aer Lingus staff, as other contributors in the programme will know, have been through, you know, reform and restructuring fatigue over the last 20 years. And we need, you know, to support our aviation sector, need state support. We've had, about 150 million euros drawn down from the ISIF fund as a 3-year loan for Aer Lingus. They've drawn that down. Okay. But what we need to do is actually look at what other EU states have done to help their airlines, because our airline sector is so important. And I know that the trade unions have been trying to negotiate with government on a kind of expanded short-term working scheme to try to assist to, you know, secure jobs in the airline industry, and we need a focus on that, because those jobs are critically important, and a strong aviation sector for Ireland, as Duncan Smith and myself have been saying for a long time, is crucially important to our business community, to jobs and our society more generally.
Okay, can I just make two brief points? One is that, you know, just when we talk about retaining rights over travel and travel rules, large parts of the EU are still in a really difficult position on the pandemic, so we have to be very, very careful about that, importation of variants and also importation of virus. Secondly, it's only last month since the pressure was on mandatory hotel quarantine from opposition and from journalists, rightly. And I'm glad to see that that's moved on, and Sinn Féin and the Labour Party have gone on to this particular page. It is really, really important for our aviation sector.
You well know that we have been looking for the implementation of the recommendations on the Aviation Task Force since it reported. Okay. Two of the 12 have been implemented. So it's the government, in fact, that are late to this, not the opposition. Okay, and you're very welcome here now, Thomas.
Okay. We'll leave that there. We'll take a break. But after this, we'll be talking about the 100,000 people waiting for their driving tests.
Saturday with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. Now, from Monday, essential workers can take essential driver training lessons with an approved driving instructor. And while that's very welcome, when will the vast majority of the over 100,000 people waiting on a test around the country be able to avail of one? Joining us now is Declan Nocton, Director of Driver Testing and Licensing at the RSA. Good afternoon, Declan.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Can you answer me that question, Declan? When will the general public be able to get their tests?
Okay, so what the public health guidance to us is that by the end of May, we will be able to start testing non-essential workers. Up to then, it's the essential workers who have applied on our urgent list basis.
Now, we know that the average waiting time for a test at the moment is 25 weeks, which is pretty staggering, 6 months. What measures are being put in place to deal with that backlog?
Well, I think one of the ironic things, Katie, is that we're only working at 80% of capacity right now because we can only test the essential workers. So once we're able to test non-essential workers, we'll get much closer to 100% capacity. So if, say, for example, in late May, early June, we can get up to our full capacity and we are taking on extra driver testers, we would expect to get that 25 weeks down to closer to 12 weeks by the end of the year.
And there's new pop-up testing centres being planned.
Yeah, so what we're doing is we're taking on 40 testers, 20 are in with us at the moment, another 20 starting on the 17th of May. And to facilitate those, we're opening up test centres. In fact, what we're really doing is expanding existing test centres by opening up local centres close by. So they're supplementing the existing centres.
And will they, these new centres, will they be in places where there's the highest demand or the longest waiting lists?
Absolutely, because we're assigning the new testers to the areas where we have the greatest needs, the longest waiting times, the highest numbers waiting. So that's the strategy that we're following in terms of placing the new testers that are coming in.
Okay, and can you tell us where? Give us an idea of where those.
Well, you know, obviously Dublin, Cork, and Galway. They're the main areas that we're focusing on in terms of adding the extra numbers. Because if you think about it, you know, we've watched. Over half of our demand is in Dublin alone.
Yeah, so I see Tala has one of the highest, longest waiting lists.
The ironic thing at the moment is that waiting lists are somewhat meaningless because we're only testing essential workers. So in actual fact, many essential workers are getting tests very quickly. So we're not taking people from the back of the list, if you understand what I mean. So the waiting list is distorted in that fashion.
Yeah, a driving instructor was in touch with us today saying, concerned that are all the essential workers really essential workers, and saying that there's very little checking, that they get an online form, they fill it out, they hand it to their driving instructor. They say, you know, if they were asked to upload it, at least there'd be some possibility that they could be checked on.
Yeah, so that's for the driving instruction, which is starting on Monday. So what we've done is we've created a form. The essential worker will have to fill that out and self-declare, and we will be doing spot checks in due course. So the activities really is between the person looking for the training and the ADI, the approved driving instructor, that'll be giving them the training.
A lot of people, and again, we've had a number of people in contact with us saying that, you know, essential workers, obviously, for business and that. But there's people like family carers, single mothers, you know, who have to do school runs and all of that, that they've been waiting now since before COVID for their tests. Like, what kind of hope can you give them that they will get on the road?
And absolutely, that's true, because we've relied on the essential worker list that's been provided by government. So that's the list that we go on when determining who's an essential worker and who's not. So what we really want to do is, end of May, beginning of June, start taking people from the back of the list and ensure that we have transparent and fair means of scheduling everybody so that those who've been waiting longest can get a driving test. And I guess the ultimate strategy is to get down to 10, 12 weeks by the end of the year.
God, and that would be the best we could do, is it 12 weeks?
We'd have 12 weeks, but we'd shorten it further then going into January and February next year. So we will get it down gradually beyond that in the months into the new year.
Okay. Can I ask you about the theory test centres? I know we've over 40 of them around the country, but they've been closed since lockdown in October.
That's correct. They did open up in December, but they have largely been closed since the 22nd of October. If there's a view out there that they're unsafe for any reason, we in the RSA, we'd love to get an opportunity to show that through the robust anti-COVID measures that it's actually safe, because you know the conditions are in keeping with all the COVID measures that we've put in place, say, for example, for driving tests. So driving tests have been going on since January, 42,000 of them, and the driver tester and the candidate sit, you know, within a metre of each other, and we've had no case of COVID. So the conditions in a driver theory test centre is, you know, is even more safe than that. So we would love the opportunity to demonstrate to the public health personnel that it is safe to open driver theory tests, because there are 100,000 people waiting for a driver theory test. And if we were to get the go-ahead to open driver theory tests, we could actually do 50,000 driver theory tests in the first month alone and get through the backlog very, very quickly.
OK, but you need the government. Let me just put that to the minister here. It seems a simple thing, Minister Thomas Byrne. Theory test centres, they're still closed, and they need them open if we're going to get people through this backlog.
Yeah, we do, and I just want to pay tribute there. I think that was, in fairness, like that was an excellent explication of what the RSA is going to be doing over the next few months. This has been, I suppose, one of the difficult parts of it. Clearly, everyone would accept that it's in a pandemic, these things were quite difficult and dangerous. I think there's a clear plan to get this back to a somewhat acceptable level by the end of the year. Looking at the burden that they've had over the last few months, and I really, really welcome that. At least people are getting serious clarity on it. Look, we'll wait for public health advice, but we fully understand that it is absolutely essential, and there's lots of young people now who just need, particularly young people, who need to get their cars, and we certainly would be hopeful that the public health advice will come on that very, very soon.
Well,
I think between Finglas and Tallaght, we're looking at nearly 20,000 people waiting. So this is an absolute crisis. But there's 79,000, nearly 80,000 people waiting on the theory test. I can't understand why it can't be put online. I mean, university exams went online. You know, other people have managed it. Something we've been calling for. My colleague Darren O'Rourke, I know, has been putting in a huge amount of work on this. And indeed, the pop-up centres that were originally, as far as I can recall, suggested by Darren O'Rourke. It's good that they're coming in now, because this backlog has to be dealt with.
I just want
too many people.
Just to
access
be clear,
to a driving licence is so important. Yeah,
absolutely.
Them, you know?
Can I just be clear about that and put that to Declan Nocton, because some driver theory tests are being done, a very limited number are being done online. Am I right about that?
Yeah, that's right. So for trucks and buses, for example, we do about 800 a month. Now, we can go online with car driver theory tests, but I suppose because of technical and individualization, that would be limited to about 4,000 a month. So while that would be welcome when we get up and running with that at the end of the month, certainly the huge effort in clearing the backlog and getting 50,000 done, it's through the bricks and mortar centre that's the best approach.
Yeah, I mean, Katie, can I Sean Sherlock has done tremendous work on highlighting this particular issue. I want to thank Declan for his contribution to putting this in context and the challenges that are out there that I think most people kind of understand. I mean, the Department of Transport have been saying now for the last while that they're piloting online theory tests, and I noticed that they've been quoted this week in the media saying that it will be really only at the back end of this year that they will be made more widely available. I mean, situations where we've got 62% youth unemployment in this country, it really is no country for younger people, looking at housing, looking at access to driver tests, looking at access to jobs. I mean, there are retailers, of course, as we heard earlier on, crying out for staff. We need to enable people to get their tests on the first step, of course, is a theory test. And we've got people, as Sean Sherlock has pointed out, being offered tests living in Cork, being offered tests in Wexford, Leitrim and so on, and that's not sustainable. I appreciate that efforts are being made to get this done, but you know, it's not beyond our ken to try to up our game from the point of view of, you know, access to online exams. You know, another contributor, okay. Louise, that said earlier on, we're doing it at third level, doing it in other contexts. Surely we can do it in respect of driver theory tests and okay. Do what Sean Sherlock has been asking us to do.
Okay, we're going to have to leave that one there. I want to thank Declan Nocton for that update, and there we'll take a break.
Tweet at Saturday RTE.
Now, the UK government is reported to be planning to introduce a ban on prosecutions of soldiers accused of committing crimes during the Troubles under new legislation to be unveiled at the Queen's speech next week. Now, before we came on air, I spoke to Mark Kelly, whose 12-year-old sister, Carlan, was killed when she was struck by a plastic bullet in Belfast in 1981. Carlan would be 53 today had she lived. I began by asking him to bring us back to what happened to on the street outside his home on May 19th, 1981.
Myself and a group of my friends were playing football in a square near my house, very close to the home. And at about 10 past 9 in the evening, we seen two British Land Rovers and two APCs, Army Personnel Carriers, coming into the estate, driving very fast, coming around through the estate towards our area. So, of course, we were obviously wanted to see what was happening. We came down the street. As I was walking down the street, Caroline was walking in front of me. She was just coming back from the shop for a neighbour. She had a pint of milk in her hand. As the Land Rover sort of passed the area we were walking in, there was a bang. They'd fired a plastic button or a plastic bullet at a group of the children that were further up the street behind me. Carlan heard the bang and turned to come back up behind the fence towards me. And there was a second shot, and she was shot behind her left ear with a plastic bullet. She fell on the ground. So I sort of standing over her, looking at her, lying on the ground, her head bleeding, her eyes opened. I knew at that moment she was dead.
You were only 13 at that time, Mark. And this
I was 13, yeah. I was a year older than her, just over a year older than her.
You have carried this for your whole life.
Yeah, myself and my whole family have carried this for their whole lives, and the other children that were on the street at the time, who would have been the same age or probably some of them a bit younger, have carried this for their whole lives.
And was it investigated at the time?
It was not investigated properly at the time, Ms. Shannon. To be honest, what I have in front of me here is the ACT report of the murder of Carlan. I know Carlan was murdered. I was standing beside her, so I seen. I know what happened. You know, people can argue whatever they want, but there's no excuse for shooting a 12-year-old child in the back of the head. So there's not. But the investigation, and even in the HET report, it was an organisation set up by the British government to investigate deaths. Unsolved deaths and injuries in the north of Ireland. Now, it was closed down in 2014 for lack of funds. They said they didn't have the funds. But they actually said that the investigation couldn't take place properly because at the time there was so much hostility in the area, so that it couldn't be properly investigated. There was no pictures taken of the crime scene. There was no weapons taken for ballistic reports. There was no interviews. There was a few interviews done from some of the adults that were there, but I have never been spoken to by the police. And I was standing beside her. I could have put my hand out and touched her. I was that close to her. And some of my friends that were there have never been spoken to. And this act now to basically give them an amnesty, and that's what they're doing. They're giving them an amnesty to walk around. So they're telling hundreds and hundreds of murderers that they can walk free. There's no investigation. Off you go. Do whatever you want.
And had you held out hope that at some stage there would be some justice for Carlan?
Yeah, there have been agreements made through peace process and various times that there would be investigations into the deaths of everyone in the north of Ireland, and the prosecutions would be brought against people that evidence was found against that they had committed a crime. There are many, many people out there who continue to tell us that, well, there's so much time has passed, people won't remember. I remember it. I can tell you that. I can remember it very clearly, and so can a lot of the other people that were there. And they then turn around and tell us that there's no money for these investigations. It's just excuse after excuse, but now we have the real truth, that they just don't want to bring prosecutions against British soldiers and members of the RUC and anyone else that committed crimes.
And what do you want to hear from the government now in response to this latest move?
Well, I think the Irish government have to come out and tell them it's unacceptable. Micheál Martin has come out and said that it's a breach of trust. A breach of trust, wow. You know, that means nothing to the people. We have the Dublin and Monaghan bombings actually down here where over 30 people were killed, including an unborn child. And these people need to know now that if this gets brought into force, there will be no prosecutions. The people who carried out those bombings will not be prosecuted under any circumstances. And the Irish government needs to tell the British government that it's unacceptable that they allow the murder and the slaughter of Irish people in Ireland, that it's unacceptable and it needs to be investigated. It's just not acceptable. That's what they need to say, but they need to say this publicly. They need to tell the people of Ireland and the people in the north, whether they consider themselves Irish or British, that they do not accept this, that there will be no investigation into the deaths and the atrocities that happened in the north of Ireland.
OK, Mark Kelly, many thanks for joining us and telling us your story today.
Thank you. Thanks very much, mate.
Minister Mark Kelly there. You know, what the Taoiseach's response so far, a breach of trust, that's just not good enough for people like him, families like him, bereaved in these circumstances.
Well, I want to thank Mark for what he said. I think it just really starkly brings home to us the reality of this for many, many families in the situation in Northern Ireland. We've absolutely reiterated time and time again to the British government that only a collective approach can work on this. Unilateral action is not acceptable on this. The Stormont House Agreement puts a pathway forward, was painstakingly agreed between the governments and the parties in Northern Ireland, and it is not acceptable for the British government to take unilateral action. Simply isn't. We can't, but you know, I can't tell them, oh, don't put something into the paper at the day of an election. You know, please have some, you know, understanding.
We're still hoping it will be dilute, whatever comes out.
Look, I mean, they clearly didn't brief the Irish government on this. I mean, this is okay. So disrespectful to people like Mark and other victims and families of victims in Northern Ireland.
OK, I'm watching the clock and there's only a few minutes left in the programme. We didn't get to the big story, which of course has been debated on every programme all week, the housing story, the investment fund swooping in to that estate in Maynooth and buying up the majority of those houses. I see that the Irish Institutional Property, that's the body that represents institutional property investors, they're saying now since yesterday that their members would support the idea of a percentage of houses in residential estates being made available for purchase by first-time buyers and other individuals. I know, Jed Mash, you don't think that's good enough, do you?
No, I think there needs to be a multifaceted approach to this, and the quickest way of actually softening the cough of REITs would be to do what happened in the UK, for example, and that's to slap a 15% stamp duty charge on those institutional investments. I mean, first-time buyers are paying 1% of a transaction charge on a house worth €300,000. That's €3,000. And so is an institutional investor. And that's just simply not on. It's not sustainable. It's not fair. You know, it's 2% over 1 million. That's all. That's really chicken feed when you look at the deep pockets that these investment funds have. So we've been calling for government to do something immediately. They can do this by resolution of the Dáil next week, and let's slap a surcharge and a larger percentage of stamp duty on transactions that involve institutional investors. Okay. That would certainly make them think again. I mean, I looked at the tax strategy group papers.
Okay, Jed, I'm cutting across you. I'm cutting across you because we're nearly out of time.
Thanks very much, Katie.
Yeah, I want to just, sorry, Jed, I'm
just for one moment, please.
Yeah,
so you refer to the vulture funds and these investors swooping in. Of course, they're not swooping in. They were invited in, and Jed will know well because he was in the part of the government with Fine Gael, who invited these people in. What they're doing is they are skewing the market so that owner-occupiers, first-time buyers, are effectively being locked out. They are competing with these real estate investment trusts who are invited here. So what Sinn Féin has been doing consistently for the last number of years when Fine Gael and Labour were in government, and indeed now that Fine Gael and now Fianna Fáil
are in
government.
Again, I'm going to cut across to Louise because we have heard this along. Would you support the stamp duty move?
It's part of our motion, and I'm absolutely delighted to see the Labour Party backing us on this. We need to end the tax advantages. We need to ensure that we impose a stamp duty surcharge, and we need measures to restrict their activity. This will be debated as part of the Sinn Féin motion on Tuesday
next
in the Dáil, and we're hoping that
final
all parties will support.
With all due respect to your correspondent there from the Vulture Funds, we have no... We do not believe these have any place in suburban Ireland in family estates. They simply do not have any place, and they need to hear that, and the measures will be brought in to make sure that that happens. It is only 1% at the moment, but we certainly don't want them to get any. Well, we do not want it to grow, and it will not grow.
Back our motion and legislate against it.
Well,
back our motion on Tuesday and legislate against it. That's a simple thing you can do. Send a message to first time buyers that you're not going to keep crucifying them, Thomas. Send that message very clearly to them.
Government legislation will be brought in. This has to be dealt with and will be dealt with. And the affordable housing bill, I hope you'll support that as well.
We've been calling for this for years, Thomas. You know that.
Afraid that is, unfortunately, all the time we have. The programme was produced by Mary O'Hagan. Research was by Andrew Fleming. The broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. And Jamie Doyle was on sound. Thank you for listening and enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Saturday with Katie Hannan. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player app.